Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
This week on Meat in 3, we're looking at factors that will shape our food world in 2019. We start with trend predictions and how media covers them.
A website could theoretically devote all their coverage to these viral trends and get all sorts of hits. That's not a way to build sustainable readerships, just as it's not a way to build, you know, sustainable restaurants.
We report on a big change coming and how street meat will be served.
On January 1st, a ban on plastic foam went into effect in New York City.
And we round out the episode with a story about using gene editing to create the spicy tomato of the future.
At first, it sounds like a gimmick or like something that you would do for fun. The truth is, there is a real value behind it.
It's not too late to make your resolution. Subscribe to Meat in 3 wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single episode this year.
Good evening, and welcome to Foment About It on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Rachel Jacobs, and tonight we have a special live from Fifth Hammer, where we have the NYC Ferments Meetup. The NYC Ferments Meetup is a meetup group that meets every month, and every month people bring what they've been fermenting, and they can talk to other people about troubleshooting, about new recipes, all that sort of things. So if you're in the New York City area, or if you're even just visiting, you should look up this group on meetups.com swing on by. There's usually a theme, but you can generally bring whatever you want. So tonight we bring some of the people who are at the NYC Ferments Meetup on Monday night. And first you'll hear an intro about what the group is about and what the theme is. And then we will talk to some of the people who brought stuff. So enjoy.
My name is Zach, and I'm one of the co-organizers of the meetup. And welcome to everybody. I see a lot of familiar faces and some new folks. So we'll do a quick go around. Tell us your name, what you brought, if you brought anything, and if you want to briefly mention kind of what your interests or experience is with fermentation, what you're excited to learn, what maybe you're excited to make, anything like that. And so I brought a koji ginger.
Hi, ladies.
It's definitely an experiment, and I have mixed feelings about how it turned out. It's sort of like a condiment paste, and I like to make nut and seed-based misos, kimchi, sauerkraut, and some other fun things. But that's what I'm excited about these days.
Very experimental.
Yeah.
So as Zach said, we are NYC Ferments. We'll do this just to give you an idea of the evening. So we'll go around the table, introduce everybody, tell us a little bit about yourself, as Zach said. And then we'll all partake in what everyone's brought and enjoy all that and ask any questions that you have of anybody that brought certain things or just to the group in general. And then at the end, we'll come back together and discuss what we're going to do next month and some other announcements that we may or may not have by the end of the evening. Okay? So I'm also a co-organizer with Zach. My name is Amy, and I brought some sourdough rye because I figured a lot of the Asian ferments that everyone's going to bring are very spicy, so you might need something to absorb that. And I don't know a lot about Asian ferments, but I have been very obsessed with sourdough, and I just keep progressing with that. I do a lot of other vegetable ferments, you know, sort of basic ones and some stuff with fruit. But really the sourdough has been my main obsession because I do have a day job so that I can afford to keep going with my hobbies like fermentation.
Okay, hi, I'm Emily. I didn't bring anything today, but I look forward to tasting everyone's stuff here. I have some update on my sauerkraut project at home from last April. I told you that I was having problems with the sauerkraut, the mold staining the jars. I started cleaning out the jars more, and I discovered that a couple inches down, the sauerkraut was actually really good, so I was able to save some of my sauerkraut. I didn't want to risk bringing it for you guys, but I am myself eating it.
You'll find it's a very adventurous crowd, though.
Hello, so we are in the back of Fifth Hammer with some of the participants from the NYC Ferments meetup group. Hi, can you tell me your name and what you brought for us today?
Yes, my name is Laura, and I brought some preserved lemons, which are used in Middle Eastern cooking. My husband's family is from Baghdad, and so there are a lot of sweet and sour dishes to which we add this, the lemons.
And you gave a whole kind of like spiel about sweet and sour dishes, and you brought like a bag of key limes. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Okay, yeah, well, the whole lemons and sweet and sour plays a big role in the Baghdadi cooking. There are a whole suite of dishes, these stews that are made with various vegetables like spinach and okra and winter squash, to which lemon is added and cooked for a long time with a little bit of tomato juice. And these can be prepared vegetarian, or you can add meatballs or chunks of lamb or whatever, and they're served over rice. So they're actually, because they're so versatile, they're great for a weekday meal. In addition, there's a tradition of something called fish dishes, to which something called numi basra are added. And these are actually limes that are from the city of Basra. And they're tiny limes that sort of look like key limes, and they come dried, and you purchase them, and you powder them, and then you make these wonderful fish patties, which have these powdered lime in them, and they also have a lot of herbs. So they're a wonderful dish, again, expanding on the whole lime and sour trend that you find in Middle Eastern cooking.
Very cool. And so you use key limes because you can't get the Basra limes here?
Yeah, that's they look pretty similar, and it's so easy. Of course, they're not fermented. I just buy them in the little mesh bags that they come in, and I just leave them out to dry on my windowsill, and they very conveniently form into these sort of like, almost like greenish ping pong balls that you subsequently use a mortar and pestle to grind into a fine powder.
Yeah, can you tell me a little more about the fish patties? Like, what kind of fish? Like, how do you make those?
Well, I think any kind of white fish, maybe cod, that has a firm texture that you could break into pieces and then mix with the powdered lime and herbs like parsley. I guess there's probably some breadcrumbs that are mixed in with that. And sort of, it comes out to the consistency and sort of like crab cakes, I imagine. But the Baghdadis, you know, Baghdad's on the Tigris and Euphrates River, right? And the fish that the Baghdadis would eat came from it was a freshwater fish. Strangely, you know, they do have a seaport entry to the ocean, but the fish that they ate was really freshwater fish from the Tigris and Euphrates River, and so that dish was developed using freshwater fish.
Let's circle back about the preserved lemon. So how did you make that, and like, do you make that a lot?
Yeah, I do. It's great to have that on hand. The preserved lemon, you know, is soft, so it isn't used in the same way that the dried lime is. But the recipe that I have calls for, in the marinade, there's a cinnamon stick, which gives it a real subtle kind of aromatic flavor. And pieces of this can be used, again, with fishes, although not in the fish patties, or it can also be added to the stewed vegetable dishes that I mentioned earlier.
And you had a favorite recipe. What book is it from?
Oh, it's from Linda Dongour's book. It's, I think, the cooking of Family Cooking of Baghdad. That cookbook basically encapsulates all those family cooking recipes that I got from my mother-in-law. So if anyone wants to explore the whole sweet and sour issue from Baghdadi cooking, they should look for that.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hello, who are you and what have you made today?
Hi, I'm Stephanie, and today I made two things. I made grilled eggplant with miso glaze, and I also made daikon radish. And you want to hear about the daikon radish?
Let's talk about both of them, but let's start with the daikon. I have to admit that this, it's for personal reasons. I'm getting a lot of daikon in my CSA, like a lot of daikon, and I need to know what to do with it.
Okay, so I salted it first overnight, and then the next day I rinsed the salt off, and then I made a mixture of miso, mirin, I think maybe a little sugar. I don't even remember if there was another ingredient or not. I don't remember. And I put it in the glaze all around, and I put a weight on top of it, and I left it outside overnight. Not outside. I mean, on the counter. Overnight. And then the next day I put it in the fridge, and I made it on January 24th. So it's like a week and a half-ish, something like that. And then to come, I rinsed half of them off, and I left the other half in the miso because I thought some people would prefer one or the other. They taste exactly the same, if you ask me. And I kind of like it with the miso still around.
I like the miso sauce too. Yeah, it's just there's something about that texture that just makes
I mean, what? Like yeah, what I liked, what I was pleased about was the fact that it still had a little crispy, like a sauce. It had texture to it, and a little bit of bite in the pickleness of it, in the sourness of it.
Yeah, it was really good. How do you suggest cutting up the daikon into like slices or like chunks is fine?
Big chunks. I made it in half-inch chunks, but actually when I was looking today to see what the other ingredients were to remember, I noticed that they made a miso pickle with rhubarb, and now I can't wait until springtime because the idea of rhubarb and me, so I'm really excited for spring to try it with rhubarb.
That does sound really cool. What's your background in fermentation? Have you made a lot of other things?
So I started with kombucha, and now I just, like, my apartment is being overrun with SCOBYs, much to my daughter's chagrin. And then I went to a fermentation festival in Brooklyn last year, and the meetup was there. And they said, oh, you should come to the meetup. So I've been coming for almost a year and trying, you know, I'm just loving it, just trying different things and just being inspired by everybody else and what they're up to.
Wait, that's amazing. How did you find the fermentation festival?
I've been to two now. I was at the one in Brooklyn and the one in the Berkshires, and they were both really quite different, one from the other, but the one in Brooklyn was more beers. And the one in the Berkshires was more mixed products. But both of them had a lot of workshops, and, you know, it's really fun. I made a fire cider, and now I'm not sure how to use. Somebody mentioned their fire cider today, and I want to find them and ask them if they drink it diluted or straight up.
Oh, I think you drink it straight up.
Do you?
Sometimes.
How much?
Usually just like a shot's worth, a couple of ounces at a time. Although I have a couple of friends that use it in mixers and make like cocktails from it. So it like works like a shrub, which is like a kind of a vinegary flavored syrup thing that you put into like a cocktail. Yeah. What are you excited to make next?
I don't know what the theme is. Ask me after they announce the theme.
What's your name and what brings you here?
I'm Arlene Jacobs. And I'm very interested in food. I was a chef. I still am, actually. I teach cooking, and so I love the alchemy of fermenting foods, watching the changes, watching something come alive. And I'm very interested in creating flavors, different kinds of flavors. I started with sourdough, which is pretty time consuming.
That's quite a way to start.
Yeah, major challenge. And then I discovered the group, and I started to come, and I'm now into miso and fermenting vegetables, and I make kefir, and kombucha, and kvass, which is a beet kvass, very refreshing drink in the summertime. So I'm hooked. I just think about it. I'm obsessed, actually. think about it all the time.
What did you make today?
Well, I had just done the miso class with Cheryl, so I made cured eggs with that had miso, kimchi juice, and fermented black beans, but, which I thought was interesting and something that I think I could snack on. I think that I would enjoy that. And I also made some tofu with mirin, soy sauce, sesame oil, ginger, and one other ingredient that just I can't, but I know it's fermented, something else that's fermented. That's what I can tell you about that one, yeah.
That sounds really wonderful. How was the workshop? Have you ever made miso before?
No, it was a start, and of course I have to wait a year. I have to be very patient. It's sitting in my cabinet, and I check it every day. But I am going to start experimenting with different kinds of grains and nuts for the miso.
What did you guys use for the workshop? Was it soybeans?
No, garbanzo beans. Yeah, so it should be interesting. But I want to branch out and. I find that very intriguing, challenging.
Yeah. You mentioned during the intro when we went around that you were trying to make tempeh and were finding it challenging. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, tempeh is made with beans or grains, and you put it through a process, and then you inoculate it, and then it forms the mycelium, which is similar to what grows underground with mushrooms. And I followed the book each time. I mean, I followed very carefully the recipes, and I have not had success. So if anybody out there would like to contact me through the group, I would love to learn more. I know there is a place where you can take classes and learning about tempeh. So.
Yeah, I think Barry still does a workshop.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Thought I'd get in touch with him and...
I think he'd definitely be interested in that. What part of the process have you been having the most trouble with?
Well, the first time I did develop a mycelium, and then I left it overnight, and by morning it was all gone. I mean, the mycelium was gone, and it was no longer alive. And then the second one I just did last weekend, nothing happened. It never got after the 12 hours of incubating. It just didn't get hot on its own, and I kept testing it with my thermometer, and it was dead. Yeah. So but I don't give up. I'm just gonna keep trying until I get it right. And I'll bring some.
Have you been making it in your own apartment?
I have a very small apartment, but I do have a proofer. Which is helpful, and I just improvise, find ways of getting it done. Yeah.
Of all of the different ferments that you've made over the years, what's your favorite to make, and what's your favorite to eat?
The bread, the sourdough bread, with a nice piece, with some nice cultured butter, a done cultured butter, and that's a real treat. I'm going to get a great crust and a great crumb, very satisfying.
Do you have a mother that you've been like hanging on to for a while?
For what? I have a vinegar mother. Oh, my starter. Yes, it's 2 years old now. Yeah, I take very good care of it. It travels with me.
Travels with you?
Yeah. Summer, we spend in Vermont. We used to spend in Vermont, and I would bring it along in a jar and keep it going all summer long. Yep.
Oh, wow. And I guess it's collected some, like, yeast from the air in Vermont,
I hope
too.
So, and from me and my environment, and I hope it has a nice personality, yeah.
I bet it does. I would love to try some of your bread sometime.
I'll have to bake one and bring it. Are you here all the time? Are you here every time?
I'm going to start coming again.
Okay. All right. I'll do that.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Thank you so much.
Sure.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
All right, hello. Who are you and what did you bring today?
My name is Arnie Schlissel, and I brought I brought a quart of kimchi from a roughly 5-quart-ish batch that I made just last week.
You said you had 11 pounds of cabbage?
Yes, I started with 11 pounds of cabbage, which is two honking big heads of Napa cabbage. I broke those down, and it became, you know, this big batch of kimchi.
How much space do you have to make that much?
Well, I do that in a studio that I keep, which is where I'm a film editor. It's the place that I often work out of. But because it has a regular, it's a studio apartment. It has a regular Manhattan-sized kitchen. So it's enough space to hold a few crocks and a few shelves of jars, and it has a normal-sized refrigerator and things like that.
Can you tell me about your process in making the kimchi, aside from cutting up the 11 pounds of cabbage?
Yes. I've read a few books over the last couple of years on kimchi making. And so I sort of extracted a recipe from that. You break down the cabbage, you dry salt the cabbage, let that sit for half an hour to an hour. While you're doing that, you make up the seasoning paste, which is largely chili flakes, but also a bit of anchovy sauce, a little bit of brine shrimp, some various other spices and things. And you let that sit and kind of come together. Then you rinse the cabbage really well, mix it with the seasoning paste, and then I pack it into a fermentation crock. I have a few crocks, including one that belonged to my great-grandmother. The crock that I used for this, I bought in Chinatown a couple of years ago. It's about 7 liters. And it has an airlocking lid so that things like kimchi, which like to ferment anaerobically, they don't get contaminated by the oxygen. And the bacteria that make it into kimchi really love that environment. And then I let that ferment for about 5 days. And you could easily tell that the activity had slowed down because it had stopped pushing liquid out through the lid of the crock. So I knew that it was kind of like, it was kind of starting to slow down and rest.
Did you put anything other vegetables or like whole spices into the kimchi?
I put some scallions in, some onion. There's nothing particularly exotic. This is like a plain vanilla type of kimchi.
Yeah, I heard you talk about that at the intro. Yeah, what experimental kimchi did you bring the last time you were alluding to?
Oh, last month I brought rutabaga kimchi. And I had also experimented with making Brussels sprout kimchi.
I've made that before. It's really good.
Yeah, it was really good for a while, but then as it aged, it got really stinky and kind of sulfurous, and I wound up tossing a bit of it out. And in the past, I also made kimchi using bok choy, which came out really, really well, and I highly recommend it. And I'm starting to get the opinion that you could probably make kimchi from almost any vegetable. I'm kind of looking forward to the summer when I can get fresh cauliflower and some other vegetables, and we'll have an opportunity to play with different kinds of kimchi. But the thing that I really like to pickle the most is more things like, you know, like kosher garlic pickles and other kinds of pickles, which are more, you know, Western, more Eastern European, the pickles of my youth, as I like to say.
Do you do fermented or brine pickles?
Yes, I do brine fermented pickles, yeah.
Sorry, not vinegar pickles is what I meant, yeah.
Not vinegar pickles, no.
Do you have any favorite recipes for that?
Oh, I do a... I've been working on a kosher garlic pickle, which I've been working on for several years, and I'm starting to almost get good at it, which is based a little bit on the joy of pickling, but I add a lot more garlic, And I've taken it forward in more in a direction I'm trying to reach the pickles that I grew up with on the Lower East Side in the 1960s. And, yeah, right. You know, the kind of pickles that you would get now from, there's a shop called The Pickle Guys, or from Gus's Pickles, or people like that. And also, I mean, I've also experimented a little bit with other variations on that, like adding extra mustard or other things, partly because it's fun. You know, it's more interesting. And then another thing that I like to do is I make a little bit of sauerkraut and sour Reuben, and I've just experimented with a lot of other kinds of vegetables, and it's just a lot of fun.
Really great. It sounds like a lot of good, like, brassica makes pretty good kimchi.
Yes. Yeah. Brassica, a lot of cabbages. You know, anything in the general family of brassica and cabbages, it usually makes a good pickle of some sort somehow.
Did you use any, like, inoculant for your kimchi batch, or was it, like, the old kimchi batch?
No. No. No, nothing. Oh, my God. Just mix everything together, shove it in the crock, weigh it down, put on the lid, and hope it doesn't overflow.
That's fantastic. What brought you to the New York City Ferment Meetup group?
I was looking to find other people who ferment stuff, other people who make pickles and other people who do other ferments. I used to bake all my own bread, although I didn't do sourdough. There's a number of people here who do sourdough breads, and it gets me interested maybe in baking again. And other people who are doing things like kombucha and playing with misos and things like that. And it's just really exciting. It's a lot of fun.
What are you looking forward to making in the future?
I'm looking forward to making some garlic pickles in the summer. Every year I pickle whole heads of garlic. I'm looking forward to that.
They don't come out like fennel-y?
No, they come out garlicky, and I just opened up the last jar that I put up last summer, and those are kind of sweet because it's those garlic heads were smaller and a little younger and more tender, and so those came out kind of sweet. They're almost like garlic candy. And I always look forward to doing that every year. It's like around the middle end of June, I start obsessively going to the farmers markets and looking at the garlic heads to see are they at the exact right stage yet for me to do this.
Is that a tip you have? Every time I've tried to like add garlic to fermentation, they've turned out blue and then also taste like fennel.
It is perfectly normal for them to turn blue. That's a chemical reaction. It is not toxic. And that tasting like fennel is also just a kind of chemical. It's an enzymatic reaction. It changes some of the flavor, some of the chemicals that create the garlic flavor become chemicals that create fennel flavor. It's a normal thing.
Do you have any tips to avoid that? Because I don't like fennel.
I don't know how to avoid that. But I do know when you pickle whole heads of garlic, they do not turn blue.
Okay.
They stay like whole heads of garlic.
Something about them staying together makes them more garlicky?
I don't know. It could be because it's really just garlic water and salt. It doesn't have any of these other things that might introduce other chemical compounds.
Thank you so much.
Anytime.
Thanks. Thank you. That was super great. Hi. All right. So what's your name and what did you bring today? What did you make today?
My name is Kim Joseph, and today I brought some fermented beets with rosemary and sage.
Can you tell me a little bit about the process that you made them?
Oh, sure. This is actually one of my first time fermenting vegetables. So I just made a brine, which is a mixture of water and salt. And then in the bottom of the jar, I put the rosemary and the sage and probably some peppercorns, I don't know, and then cut up the vegetables and then put them in the jar, and then I poured the brine over top. And then for a weight to weigh down the vegetables below the liquid, my my roommate recommended using like a plastic Ziploc filled with water. So I did that. And that day I also did some watermelon radishes and carrots and leeks.
Nice. Have you tried any of those yet?
Yeah, they're all really good.
So what made you want to foray into making vegetables?
Well, it began with the sourdough, but I belong to a CSA, and we get wonderful, beautiful vegetables from Golden Earthworm Farm on Long Island. And we just had so many vegetables, and I thought, well, I think, you know, I have to ferment some of these to preserve them. And also just wanting to include more fermented food in my daily diet.
Oh man, yeah. What other things from your CSA have you fermented? The leeks and the radishes?
Yeah, just the watermelon radishes, and then the carrots and leeks and the beets.
Yeah, let's go back to the sourdough. So you usually make sourdough. Tell me about how that started and what kind of breads you like to make.
I do make sourdough. About 3 years ago, I went to a friend's house for dinner, and she sent me home with two loaves of sourdough bread. And at that time, I wasn't eating bread because I was having difficulty digesting it. Plus, I also had just returned from living in Asia, and I was eating rice. So anyhow, I took her wonderful bread home, and I ate it. And I didn't have any. It was easy for my body to digest. So I asked her to teach me. So I need to learn how to make this bread, you know? And so that started about 3 years ago. And every week I would make a loaf of bread and try until it got to the point where I was already selling like cakes and cookies and things at my CSA. And I had thought, okay, let me bake some bread and bring it and see if anyone's interested. And they were, and it sold, and so that's when my business began. It's called Little Wild Branch Bakery.
Little what?
Little Wild Branch Bakery. And so I don't have a physical location, but I rent space at the Queensboro Restaurant in Jackson Heights. And so I use their space when they're not using it to bake. So I bake my bread actually in a pizza oven.
Can I ask about that process? So I've made a little bit of sourdough bread. I was unemployed for like 2 weeks, and I spent the whole time making sourdough bread because it takes like 3 days. So I don't have a Dutch oven, so I ended up using these circular, they're quiche pans basically. But like, I feel like I would always have a better outcome with like a Dutch oven, but I don't imagine you use a Dutch oven in a pizza oven.
No, and that's how I did it at home. I used to bake with a Dutch oven or a cloche or, you know, some kind of a clay baker. And in the pizza oven, when I first started using it, I had to learn how to bake all over again. It was a, you know, completely different process, and I developed a certain dough that works best in that oven, like something that's more substantial, bakes well. Yeah, because it's the hardest part is to get enough steam in the oven. So if you can visualize me standing there after I put the loaves in with spray bottles of water and spraying, you know, as fast and as much as I can, like on the walls of the oven to create steam.
Does it cook very quickly?
So that also took me quite a while, a bit of time to figure out the process of that. So what I do now is I bake them for about 10 minutes until they get enough color. And then I switch the loaves to a regular oven to finish baking at a lower temperature so that because they were becoming really dark. So in this way, I can get the color that I want and then shift them to finish baking in another oven.
That sounds really great. And you sell them at the CSA on Long Island?
The CSA is in Jackson Heights, Queens. And that's the main space where I sell is at the CSA. But also, like during the off season, I set a time at the restaurant, at the Queensboro restaurant, where people can come and pick up their bread. So a lot of it is like by order, but I always make some extra. And so if anyone is there at the restaurant that wants to buy bread, they can buy bread. And then I also, the restaurant uses my bread on their brunch menu on the weekends. So it says the avocado toast.
That is so awesome. And yeah, and if listeners are interested in getting this bread, like, where can they go? Is there a website? Is there like a...
Yeah, you can find me at littlewildbranchbakery.com. I'm also on Instagram as Little Wild Branch Bakery and on Facebook.
That is so awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. Nice meeting you.
You too. So we are here with at Fifth Hammer with one of the co-organizers of NYC Ferment's meetup group, Elmo. And today you made two different kimchis from two different eras. Is that right?
That is right. One is significantly older than the other. One I made on Saturday, and the other has been sitting around my house for about a year.
So what is the difference between them aside from their ages?
You can notice the difference when you look at them because they're two different colors. The older kimchi is definitely a lot paler than the newer kimchi. The newer kimchi is much more red. And also the leaves of the things that are part of the kimchi. The bok choy in the newer one and the napa cabbage in the older one are very different. The napa is much paler and the newer kimchi hasn't had time to fade. So it's very vibrant and green.
The flavors are way different also.
The older kimchi has had a lot more time to mellow out, so you get the heat on the back end. Where the younger kimchi, it's crunchy and it's bright and all of the heat is in front and ends pretty quickly.
Can I ask you about the process? Let's start with the older one, because I pulled out some of it and I pulled out a whole head of cabbage. How do you make it and why is it in enormous pieces?
So I taught myself to make kimchi because I didn't know anybody else who made it by watching Korean ladies on YouTube. And the way that they make it is by putting whole quarters of the cabbage, stuffing quarters of the cabbage, and packing those into the jar with the core still attached. So that's the way that I still make it. Even the bok choy kimchi that I made is not separated from the cores. But the bok choy is much, much smaller, so it's a little easier to get on your plate.
Yeah, was it baby bok choy? It was very small.
It was baby bok choy, yeah.
Okay, normal pieces. Do you, you chop up your kimchi generally after it's already fermented and, as you eat it?
I don't usually just eat kimchi. I use kimchi to make other things. Unless it's a younger kimchi and I'm just using it as a side dish or a topping for rice, I'm usually using it for something else, like a kimchi jjigae or kimchi pancakes.
You mentioned that you put honey in your kimchi. So where does that go in the process?
So part of the process of making kimchi is that you have to make a porridge that's the base for the spice paste that goes with whatever the main, I call it the medium. That's not a technical term, but the medium that you're using. So whether it's daikon radishes or napa cabbage, whatever the main constituent vegetable is for the kimchi. So in my paste, when I'm making the porridge, I use rice flour and red miso and buckwheat honey. And the red miso and buckwheat honey add the umami sort of back end that I'm not getting from using fermented fish or fermented shrimp, because I make everything that I do vegetarian.
Any particular reason for that? Are you vegetarian?
I am vegetarian, and I've been vegetarian for a long time, but mostly I do that so if anybody wants to try the things that I'm making, if they're vegetarian, then they can.
That's very accessible. It sounds like your kimchi is a lot more complicated than mine. I have three ingredients in my kimchi.
Yeah, the kimchis that I make, especially the pechu kimchi that I make, takes about 8 hours, because sweating the cabbages takes most of forever. It takes a really, really long time.
How long do you sweat your cabbages for?
6 hours.
6 hours?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so, in the morning I get them together and I wash them and I cut them in half and get them ready, salt them, and then start sweating them. And over about the course of 6 hours, I turn them every half hour. And sort of rebased the salt water that's coming off of them over the cabbages. And then once they've sweat out for about 6 hours, that's when, over that time, I've already made the paste and, the porridge that goes with all of the other things, the onions and the carrots and soybean sprouts and things like that, that are going into the paste. That's all been prepared over that time. It usually gives me time to make other things too. I also make things that aren't kimchi, and you know, I make krauts and stuff like that. And just regular pickles, you know, just good old cucumber pickles. And it gives you a whole day to do it, but it's really, it's one of my favorite things to do. It's one of my favorite things to spend a whole day doing.
What is the advantage of sweating it for 6 hours versus like the usual like half an hour to an hour?
If you're sweating it for a half an hour to an hour, the leaves will wilt a little bit and you will get some water out of them and some salt will absorb into the vegetable, but you're not going to get as much of all of that unless you do it over a longer period of time.
Much stronger flavor and much...
Right. I mean, what you're doing by... Not to get boring, but what you're doing by...
You like science?
What you're doing by dry salting all of those leaves is you're setting up osmotic pressure that's not only pulling liquid out of the vegetables, you're also pulling salt into the vegetables. So in the end, the flavor is going to be more intense the more that osmotic process, the osmosis is pulling that salt into the cells of the cabbage.
Awesome. Yeah, what are you looking forward to making next month? What's next, and what's next month's theme?
Next month is pickles as parts, so that means that we're not just looking for whatever dressing you're making for your salad, whatever the vinegars are, the krauts and things like that, but the ways that you're going to use them. So I'll probably end up making something like kimchi pancakes, because my main thing is kimchi. I make mostly kimchi. But, you know, you could also ferment some onions and carrots and make pakoras with them. You could... ferment your potatoes prior to making latkes. You could make sourdough bread that then turns into a sour sweet bread pudding. There are lots and lots of options.
That sounds like the best thing. I once made kefir cream cheese that I then turned into cheesecake, I think.
That sounds fantastic.
It was very watery, but like, it was all right.
You could also use some cultured butter in the graham cracker crust for your...
Oh, that's a good idea, too. I think I just used Keebler. that works so much better. I'm going to make that next time, I think. All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
The Meta Belt.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.